This is a Pinball News production.
Gottlieb was my first career job. And at college, I had written letters to all the game companies except Chicago Coins and sent resumes. But you can imagine the excitement when I got a letter from Gottlieb asking me if I would like to come to the plant to discuss employment in the engineering department. I still have that letter. In fact, I brought it with. Plane tickets were at the airport, and we were ready to go. I arrived. Wayne Nines gave me a tour of the plant on Saturday, so things were quiet. We couldn't go into engineering. It was off limits for employees only. Okay, anyway, couldn't go into engineering. Now, we worked our way to the back of the plant, you know, touring all the departments. When we got to the back was the punch press department. And there was someone working on one of the presses when we got back there. And climbed down, wiped grease from his hands, apologized for the grease, shook my hand, and introduced himself as Alvin Gottlieb. I've spoken before, of course, about life at Gottlieb, and the one thing that everyone finds so amazing is that we had hot lunches cooked for us every day. It was an outstanding benefit even back then, and applied to all the front office people. There was a separate lunchroom and a small kitchen attached. Our cook was Liz, and she would begin cooking every morning about 10 o'clock, and pretty soon the smell of a hot meal just spread everywhere. These were real meals, I mean dinners actually. And there was a meat and a veg and a dessert. So sometimes she cooked crepes and nuts for us. It was sort of like what we had here tonight. For this, we paid $2 a week, which Wayne Nines collected from us every Monday morning. You know, today this would be considered just unhealthy, eating like that in the middle of the day, and then presumably going home and eating like that again for dinner. I mentioned that the engineering department was locked. The story goes that back when the Flipper was being developed in 1947, Bally came out with a game right around that time called Nudgy. I believe it had a sliding play field or something where you could bounce the ball back up the field. The point was, though, that it was player control. And ignoring the adage that the great minds run in the same direction, Dave Gottlieb suspected that some outsider may have actually leaked this information about the Flipper to Bally. So from that moment on, only engineers and, of course, management were allowed into the department. Our engineering department was a large area, and there was game cabinets in the middle and offices and workbenches all around, and a separate drafting department behind a glass wall and, of course, a door. There was a big Diazo blueprint machine in there and flat file cabinets along the whole wall. It's inconceivable in this day and age that all those drawings were made by hand. And all those flat files represented had the originals. I don't recall if we ever had microfilm backup. I don't remember. The drafting department also assigned part numbers when a new drawing was needed. They took the next available number and then prefixed it with the sheet size. So when you see Gottlieb part numbers, it would be, say, like B-1234. That just meant that item was on a B-size drawing. The engineering department always smelled good. It was a blend of wood and warm games and cotton wire and sometimes coffee. Unfortunately, there were sometimes the smell of cigarette smoke. A few people, would smoke while they worked. It was a different time, a whole different time. Oh, about the engineering department, about the drafting. On some of the older schematics, you will see at the bottom next to the game number, there is often the initials RFG. That stood for Roman F. Garbar, who was the chief mechanical designer. He had been there since right after World War II, and he was always called Doc. And I believe it was because the guy was short, heavy, and bald, great guy, but I think he sort of put a lot of people in mind of Doc of the Seven Dwarfs. Until he came to Gottlieb, it wasn't that old a movie. I never heard him addressed or referred to by any other name besides Doc. One time, Doc made a new set of drawings for a new game carton. As any of you move games around know, the carton is a critical component. And we had drawings for all the cardboard pieces. I think this was for one of the wide body cabinets. I'm not sure. But when samples of the carton came in, They were complete with the Gottlieb logo and the this side up and everything. But also, right in the middle of the curtain were the words, "Do not dork." In engineering, you have to check everything. A real discovery for me shortly after I got there were Adiballs. I had never seen anything like that. And with the American Adiballs, the big numbers along the bottom of the back glass look so different from the replay games. We have some here. I think we've got some here on the floor, some American Adiballs. Even more amazing to me were the Italian Adiballs, because they were even more different, really, two games in one. I always thought they would do great on any location in this country, but of course that was not to be. With the Italian games, it was tacitly understood that we were not to discuss these games outside the company. Of course, everybody, a lot of people in Europe knew about them, but Gottlieb always regarded them as sort of a secret weapon for our market in Italy. Of course, they were built for 230 volts and 50 hertz power. We had a motor generator set tucked away somewhere. I don't remember where that thing was, but we had a special outlet in the room where we played the games. Even though the company made pay tables and consoles back in the 1930s, and actually two models of one balls, Gottlieb's later antipathy toward gambling machines was legendary. During the 1950s and 60s, there were constant legal challenges to pinball and the definition of gambling, and Dave Gottlieb really felt that the taint of gambling could ruin the industry. One time, somebody at Gottlieb had to take a bingo backglass downtown to a court case. And Dave would not permit that guy to take that glass out the front door, even though his car was parked there. He was afraid, Dave was afraid, that somebody driving by on Costner Avenue might see that backglass and associate the whole company with gambling. So the guy had to take the glass to the back dock, load it from, and leave from there. Oh, but in later years, this attitude definitely softened, for I was actually once asked to design a bingo. Gottlieb bingo seemed like a severe contradiction, but at the time, management felt that there could be a market for bingos in Mexico. So first thing I did was to make sure our system could support that type of game. I think that was system two. It could, more or less. And I got so far as to write software and decide on specific features. One of the things I was going to put on it was I had one of those selector knobs that you see on some Bally bingos and like all United bingos. It looks like a TV channel selector. It was you use it to select spot a number with it. I had one of those units, and we were going to reverse engineer it and make it and put that in. I got to the point where I was going to do a playfield layout, and then I got called to the front office and told that the project was off. Too many legal problems. It was so close. I mean, you know, who knows? From today's perspective, some gambling equipment might have saved the company. Might have been just what was wanted. All over the engineering department in the video years, there was empty upright cabinets for video games, which we built at the plant in Bensonville. I really wanted to use one of those upright cabinets for a game. It just seemed a natural. And I ended up building like a ball catcher game. Small balls trickling down a panel, and then you move the lever and caught it, you know, with the catcher at the bottom. There were some rollovers on the panel, and to change the catch value, and a few other features. It was sort of like a blend of pachinko and the kicker catcher game. Management liked the idea and told me to have 6 units made. So we had artwork made, and cabinets were ordered, and the game was called Grab It. And we assembled the 6 units in an improvised line out in the shop. The games were put on location, someplace, you know, around here. And after that, I lost track of them. They never came back to the plant. I would sure like to know if anybody's ever seen one of those. That would really be a collectible, since there's only 6 in existence. There was a running joke in engineering about one of the colors for artwork. When a game was being developed, artwork samples would come in for approval. There was a playfield, a backglass, and a set of plastics. Mind you, there was no choice of art. It was just, this is it. And the only thing we could look at were minor changes in the color combination. No matter what the theme of the game, there was always an abundance of magenta. You can see it on the Gottlieb Games on the floor. It was a lousy color. It was so dark and full of gray. There was always an abundance of this. We always said that Ed Poster must have bought a war surplus tank car of that stuff or something. They loved it. They loved it. Also on every glass from that era is a figure. One of the figures will always have a bony pointing finger. Again, take a look when you go up there. I don't know why. I felt at the time even that in general, you know, compared to the artwork in the old days, what we were getting was, well, hasty. I thought it was kind of plain. And we could always depend on that magenta. The only time I can ever remember artwork being changed was shortly after I got there. We had got the artwork for Big Indian and Big Brave. I liked that game. That was one of the few non-symmetrical playfields of the time. But I wasn't comfortable with that name for the four player. It was Big Indian. I mean, come on, guys, this is the 1970s. You can't use a name like that, you know? So I discreetly mentioned my concern to one of the salespeople, and shortly thereafter, a more politically correct glass arrived in engineering. Oh, I wish I'd snagged that sample. I wish I had that glass. I did break a glass one time. Oh, man. All the executives were watching me, or were in the room looking at sample colors. I was switching glasses back and forth for them. And I crashed one of those glasses into the side of the cabin. And, you know, there was a pistol shot, and all of a sudden I was holding nothing. It was like magic. What happened? I didn't know what happened. At least they weren't angry, and they left and so I could clean up. And I went and got the shop back, and when I came back, the pieces were still breaking on the floor. You go into the room, and all around it sounded like Rice Krispies everywhere. Gee, and it was a mess. I hope nothing like that ever happens to you guys. Well, for two reasons. First of all, a tempered glass usually is going to meet an original glass, and we don't need to lose any original glasses. But the other thing is the mess. I mean, when I cleaned this thing up, there was other games in there with no top glass, and there was pieces of the glass in the bottoms of all the other games in the room. So, you know, if this ever happens to you and you've got games around you with no top glass, it's just like somebody walked in and just threw a handful of rice. You know, it's just everywhere. The final testing area was called the Bull Ring, because the final testing area at Costner Avenue plant was in a circle. And the Bull Ring, the whole game was brought together for the first time. Now, this was final inspection, final checking. It was right outside of engineering, because sometimes they would have problems. They'd ask us to come out and troubleshoot it for them. One time, they called us out and said they were getting shocks from the 6-volt light sockets. Well, that isn't right, so we went out to have a look. And sure enough, we were getting a moderate shock if we touched either side of a display socket. Now, the game was normal. The game looked good. The lights were okay. The game played. Now, I ask you, anybody have any idea what would cause that?
Short ground.
You're getting a shock when you touch the 6-volt wire.
Electricity.
Yeah, right.
Nobody has an idea.
Missing ground on the ground floor.
No, because the shock was if you touched the cabinet. The other cabinet was the three wire power cords. You touch the molding, touch the front door, touch a socket, you get a shock. Enough to feel it. No idea.
It was a three-prong cord?
It was a three-prong cord. It was connected right. Yeah. Okay. It was a very unusual thing, obviously. It was not a common thing. What's that?
Your source could have had a cycle on the wall.
Oh, okay. No, actually, what it was, the voltmeter told the story. What it was, one side of the socket was at 70 volts above ground. The other side of the socket was at 76 volts above ground. The socket, the bulbs were seeing the difference, 6 volts, so they were fine. What it was a faulty transformer. The whole 6-volt winding was floating at 70 volts above ground. So we changed the transformer, and that was it. But I never saw another one of those. That was a good one. That was a good one. We had a few good scandals in our day, too. We sold scrap, the reclamation services. I know, of course, we sold the metal, you know, from the punch press. I think we also might have sold the Bakelite. I'm not sure, but definitely the scrap steel. And it turned out there was a chap in the stock room that dealt with this that was falsifying the weight and getting a kickback on the difference. Well, he didn't last long. Another time, there was a supervisor who had, well, we'll just say he was a supervisor, and I guess he got into it with some guy, and after work one day, this supervisor pulled a knife and stabbed the guy. Everything was all right. I mean, everything was okay, but obviously that supervisor had to go bye-bye, too. So as in later years, you know, as management came and went, they were more and more corporate and less coin-op. You know, they just didn't have the feel of the industry. One time, they felt that components were getting too expensive to make, and so they got the bright idea of trying to buy as many parts as possible from Weico. Oh, geez, of all places, they asked me to build a good, not too expensive single player game from the past that we could recreate using all Weico parts. I chose, I think it was Flip-A-Card, which is a pretty basic single player sequence card game theme. And I did it. I bought a ton of stuff from Weico and put the game together, and the effect was pretty tepid. It was pretty lukewarm. The game played like a home game, you know? And at least management realized that quality and playability were a little more important than expense. And that was the end of that calamity. Another time we got a big can bending machine in engineering. This was right after a Coke bought Columbia. And strange thing though, that vendor was there for a couple of months and nobody ever told us what it was for. The rumors were going around that they wanted maybe two things. They wanted maybe a talking vending machine, or they wanted some unit in it that would dispense tickets or coupons. We could have done either. I was kind of looking forward to working on the ticket unit. That would have been kind of fun. Nothing was ever said, though, and about a couple of months later, vendor was gone. A lot of strange things like that toward the end, you know. It really was sad to see the company go downhill. I mean, first there was the change to Milestar. Jeez. We all derisively call it Millstar, as in millstone. During that period, the engineering department was moved into the shop along an outside wall in the back of the facility. They did a nice job. It was there were lots of offices and a big central area, but ultimately it was just window dressing. You know, ironically, the old engineering department was taken over by management, and by that time, the number of managers and administrators just about outnumbered the workforce in the shop. The real coup de grace, though, came when all the tooling in the punch press department was sold off. All those machines and die sets and jigs and fixtures must have brought a good amount, but it was really the end of an era to see them haul away that very punch press that Alvin was working on when I had met him 12 years ago. What really made that company, though, was the people. Something I clearly remember about Gottlieb was the generosity. In about 1978, I was out of work for about 2 months because of an illness. Some people came to see me in hospital, of course, and that was very nice. But I remember Judd Weinberg, the president, calling my wife and telling her not to worry about the paychecks, you just worry about getting me well. I had long since, you know, used up any accrued time that I had, and yet a check came every week. I can't imagine that happening anyplace else. That company, you know, values people, and that's a rare thing. Of all the people in engineering, certainly the three pillars were Alvin Gottlieb, Wayne Nyans, and Ed Kresge. Eddie is no longer with us, but he certainly was the most prolific designer after Wayne became chief engineer. Eddie gave his friendship carefully. He liked to work alone, but from that solitude came some of the best games Gottlieb ever turned out. Alvin, of course, was management, and he was an integral part of engineering. And with his position and contacts, he was constantly promoting the business and bringing new ideas into engineering. And in the middle of it all was Wayne Knights. It was a position he obviously relished. He was involved with everything, above and below and all around. Sometimes I don't know how he kept everything together, but certainly his skill and personality kept us moving forward. As for me, my greatest benefit of having been at Gottlieb was that I met my wife there. We had a blind date set up by someone at Gottlieb, and the date was on the night before she was to start at Gottlieb in the purchasing department. So a few years later, we were married on 9/11, and that was 25 years ago, in pinball romance. Every company, you know, has an atmosphere, a zeitgeist, and the game companies were certainly no different. That character is reflected in the way the people were treated and in the sort of people who found themselves at home in a particular company's ways. At Gottlieb, there certainly was a sense of group and of common purpose. I think it's kind of regrettable that today there seems to be no one left who can discuss the day-to-day character of some of the other great companies from the past, like Western, United, and Keeney, and Exhibit, and even ABT. I dare say there's probably some people in this room who've never even heard of those names. That's a shame. I mean, so much has been lost. And one of the purposes of this expo is for the preservation of both hardware and heritage. And I think it's incumbent upon us all to capture and conserve as much history as possible. And I'm really grateful. I'm glad that I can be a small part of this just by having had a once-in-a-lifetime job in a once-in-a-lifetime company. So I thank you.